Welcome to the Duff and Quarters podcast, brought to you by Tab Touch. Today, I, Mark Duffield, and Braden Quatermain, the senior football writer from the Sunday Times, will look at the fortunes of West Coast and Fremantle in 2019. We'll discuss new rules, and we'll talk about the grand final reviews we've done of West Coast 4 premierships, and also my top 50, which is appearing in the West Australian and the Weekend West over the next couple of days.
What's your name?
You're quite brilliant. Yeah, terrific.
Oh, that is... Oh, that's what it is.
The stadium holds its breath.
It's Duff and Quarters.
Brought to you by Tab Touch.
Well, hello everybody. It's Thursday, which means it's time for another edition of the Duff and Quarters podcast. It is the podcast where we let the cobblers do the cobblering. And we can still call it the Duff and Quarters podcast today, but there is a bit of a difference to it. Instead of Glenn Quatermain, the sports editor of the Sunday Times, with me in the studio, I have Braden Quatermain, the senior football writer and senior sports reporter for the Sunday Times. Braden, hello. What's happened to your boss, mate? Where is he?
It might be a planned deload just before round one, I reckon, Duff. Thanks for having me. Good to be here. And it's good to know that Quarters isn't irreplaceable. I think I'm the one person in the office who can step into his shoes.
So he's suffering from general soreness, is he?
A bit of general soreness and a school camp, I think. Yeah, just before round one, so a few days out of the office.
He's been sent off for scans, I think. I think we'll hear on Tuesday or Wednesday that he's going to miss two or three. But no, he'll be back with us on Tuesday as we have the big lead-in, of course, to the now traditional Carlton Richmond season opener on Thursday night. So, Braden, it's a big couple of days for a couple of West Coast players. They will go through an intra-club hit-out tomorrow at Subiaco Oval, I believe. That Josh Kennedy and Brad Shepherd in particular will play a couple of quarters in that, and then they will decide on their availability for the round one clash against Brisbane. Question for you, from what you know about Josh Kennedy and his history, because he's the one that's had the really interrupted lead-in, I guess. Would you play Josh Kennedy off no match practice in Brisbane if he shows himself to be fit tomorrow?
I think if Josh Kennedy's fit, he clearly makes any team, but I think a more interesting point is I reckon the Eagles are better placed to cover for Josh Kennedy than at any point they've been for many years. I don't think there's so much urgency for him to play in round one on a hard deck when perhaps he could have another week and they could take a slightly more conservative route. With Jack Darling in the form he was in early last year, and hopefully from the Eagles' point of view, he'll reprise that. And with a lot of young key position options desperate for a chance, I'm not sure they'll feel pressure to play him.
So from what we've seen this preseason, would you agree that Oscar Allen would be front and centre to take Josh's place if he's not ready?
It looks like it. They look very keen on him and he looks really exciting. So he's probably jumped over Jake Waterman, who actually played a lot of games last season and was, you know, at one stage a first choice player and probably a bit stiff to miss out come finals time. But certainly I would say the order now probably looks like Oscar Allen, then Waterman, and then probably Jared Brander looks like he's got a big future as well, but might be just a little bit behind development-wise where the other two are.
They sort of look like they're still trying to find a use for Brander, don't they? I think Allen has his role in the structure. Waterman, I wouldn't be surprised if Waterman still plays. They've still got to find a replacement for Mark Lacroix in that structure that won in the 2018 flag. And I get the feeling that of all the young players, Waterman may be the player most suited to that role. He seems to be the one that understands how he fits into a team structure and certainly their forward line structure. I guess the other big question that you would have to ask yourself if you're West Coast is, if Josh Kennedy does get up, does Oscar Allen still play, given that he's kicked five goals in two JLT Community Series matches?
You possibly could, and they did play the three talls last year, if you classify Waterman as a third tall alongside Kennedy and Darling. But you would think they're also going to go the two rucks with Hickey and Vardy. So potentially it does get a little bit tall. It probably depends as well what happens down back with Will Schofield's fitness, because of course we saw Oscar Allen actually made his debut for West Coast as a defender. So whether they still have a mind, whether he could be throwing back as well, there's a lot of moving parts, I think, when it comes to West Coast selection.
A couple of other players, based on what we know and what we've seen and based on what we think they'll be trying to set up. You, two ruck structure, so both Hickey and Vardy play?
I think so. And they'll basically be in a shootout for the first half of the season until Big Nick gets back, because there's only going to be room for one of them when that happens. So, I mean, West Coast were one of the very few teams in the competition to go with a sort of two genuine rucks in recent years. But I think we might see more of that this year with the new rules. There's going to be a premium on centre clearances. The new rule allowing ruckmen to grab the ball straight out of the ruck without being penalised as having had prior opportunity as well. So I think there's I think two rucks is the way to go if you've got them.
I don't understand that rule, you know. I think I like most of the other rules, and Quarters and I have discussed the other rules on previous podcasts leading into this season. But the one where they're basically encouraging the ruckman to take clean possession, to me, just almost leads to secondary stoppages and more congestion around the ball, because players will be able to converge in and create that congestion they're trying to avoid.
Well, and the interesting point you raise is that, so take last year's grand final, for example, West Coast, a handful of points in front in the final minute. Does a ruckman just take the ball out of the air and go to ground and just go for repeat stoppages and kill the clock? I actually spoke to Nathan Vardy about this a couple of weeks ago, and he didn't think you could get away with doing that. He thought the holding the ball rule would still be policed in a way that it wouldn't be able to be used as a time-wasting mechanism. But it certainly is interesting, and that's one of the points that has been raised. If you can knock seconds off the clock and you're a big, strong ruckman that can just get it to ground, and you know you can't be pinged.
Absolutely. Have you liked what Tom Hickey's done so far this pre-season with what you've seen?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at what, I mean, effectively, I guess they lost Lycett and brought in Hickey, but there's also a net gain in terms of picks as well there. So they've brought in Hickey, presumably on a fair bit less money than what they would have had to have paid Lycett to keep him. Plus, there's been a net gain with picks. I think, you know, West Coast have turned a situation that wasn't ideal into a win, as long as Hickey stands up and can play some decent footy.
Yeah, and I think they can probably thank Scotty Clayton, I think, for Tom Hickey's presence at the club. I know that Scott Clayton was a massive fan of Tom Hickey, got him to the Gold Coast, continued to follow his career when he went to St Kilda, and, of course, West Coast got Scotty Clayton across last year to help them with their Melbourne office and their Melbourne operation, and part of that would have been their East Coast recruiting, and he was certainly keen to get him on board, and he looks like, I think, a good choice in terms of adding depth to that ruck brigade until they get Nick Natanui back. Before we go any further, just a reminder to all our listeners, before the start of the season, with it only a week away, make sure you register at thegame.com.au for our footy tipping and Pick 7 fantasy competitions. There is a Mazda BT50 with a Boss Adventure Pack worth more than $67,000 in total up for grabs. So get to thegame.com.au, register for footy tipping and Pick 7 fantasy competitions to be in the running for that great prize. Quarters, moving on to Fremantle. We saw Ross Lyon's big interview in the West Australian this week. What do you make of the Dockers, their lead into the season, and what sort of season are you expecting them to have?
There's some storm clouds with injuries. It's clearly not the way you'd want to go into a season, but I think people are underestimating the great draw Fremantle have for the first 3 weeks. I think there's every chance, and round one is just huge for them, as it is for a lot of teams in setting the tone. If Fremantle can get over North, and obviously Fremantle will be an undermanned outfit that day, I think the Dockers will be 3-0 leading into the Derby. How's that going to set up a Derby against West Coast, the reigning premiers, in round four?
That'll be fun, I reckon. Yeah. West Coast home game, of course, that Derby. Andrew Brayshaw obviously copped a big hit from Andrew Gaff late last year, ended his season. It looks to me like he's made a really strong return from that. His two games against Collingwood and West Coast in the two JLT Community Series matches. Obviously, we had the big pre-match handshake with Andrew Gaff down at Mandurah on Sunday. But he looks like no ill effects from that, been very strong, head over the footy, and probably almost Fremantle's best player over those two matches.
Yeah, he looks like he's genuinely taken a step up. What he didn't actually have big numbers last year, and they did throw him into the middle for a lot of time on ball, which was a big ask for a kid in his first year. What he did have last year was big tackle numbers, but not big stats in other areas. But he looks like he's certainly going to find more of the ball and more clearances, which is something they definitely need.
Absolutely. I guess the big question for Fremantle is, where does their midfield come from, given that we won't see Stephen Hill probably until round two or three, and we may not see Connor Blakely until about round five? If you're Ross Lyon and you are looking for four players to put in the middle for that first bounce against Ben Cunnington and Sean Higgins and co against North Melbourne in round one, who alongside Sean Darcy are your other three mids, obviously Nathan Fyfe being one?
If we know anything about Ross Lyon, it's that he'll fall back to what he knows. And I think the answer to that question is Fyfe, Mundy, Walters. Mundy goes back into the midfield, certainly for the early part of this year, until the cavalry can come back and help. We know he's done it for a long time, and he was great last season in a bit of a hybrid role, midfield forward. But I think until Blakely and Stephen Hill get back on deck, Mundy's just going to have to go back in the middle, and he'll probably do it for them. He's a great player. And at 33, I'm sure he's got a bit left to give.
And the worry, I guess, with Mundy is going to be, how does he see the season out? So I think you're right. I think in burst early in the season, and then maybe find ways to deload him, Braden, as the season goes on. If they can manage him properly, I think they will get still a pretty good result out of a very good player in David Mundy. He's probably one of the most underrated great players in the AFL over the last 6 or 7 years, I think, David Mundy.
And he will get his due come round six if he can stay on deck, because, of course, that's when he's due to play his big milestone game. That'll be at home. And I think that might be the Len Hall game on Anzac weekend, where he's due to play his 300th. So as long as he stays on the paddock round six, he'll become just the second player, WA-based player in history to play 300 games. So a great effort.
How have you liked the new Fremantle forward setup? Obviously, Jesse Hogan, Rory Lobb, Brennan Cox has played there a bit, will be injured for round one. Matt Tavern has played there a bit, will be injured for round one. So we can probably expect to see Cameron McCarthy in that lineup against North in round one. But how have you liked what you've seen from Hogan and Lobb in the first two rounds? To me, Hogan had trouble connecting with his teammates against Collingwood, but was better against West Coast. Lobb was probably the other way around, very strong, mainly as a ruckman against Collingwood and quieter against West Coast.
Speaking of Ross Lyon, I thought Lyon said something very interesting the other day when he was asked about some injuries to their tools going down. He said, we'll have a smaller forward line and that mightn't be a bad thing. That says to me that he's got some worries about whether they've got enough pace and tackling pressure around these big boys. And I think that's a valid point. Of course, we've all been seduced all summer that Fremantle's finally got these tools who can take some marks that they've been chasing for so many years. But if the ball's going to come out just as quickly, that's going to be an issue, and they could be exposed there. And also, given the midfield problems, Michael Walters might have to spend more of his time middle than forward as well. So they'll certainly need some speed and some tackle pressure around those big guys. But as Lobb is a very interesting one. He's a very good ruckman for a player who says he doesn't like playing in the ruck.
He is, yeah.
And when you get, it's all very well coming to a club and signing a contract and saying, you'll be playing here, yes, I don't want to play in the ruck. You get to the cut and thrust week by week. Every game coming up is a must-win game. Rory Lobb might end up doing more ruck work than he expected to this season, especially if Sandilands and Darcy keep having issues with their bodies.
Yeah, Darcy looked rusty, I think, against West Coast last week, and I think that definitely showed up in the clearance numbers. I think it was 57 or 55 27 overall West Coast way, 18-5 out of the middle, and the whopper was six goals from stoppages inside West Coast attacking 50. So I think they felt that there were times when Darcy got his body positioning wrong and sort of, if anything, cleared a path for the West Coast midfielders as opposed to bulldozing a path for the Fremantle midfielders. I think he's a good young player, Sean Darcy, and I think he'll get better. But I do agree with you. I think with Darcy being so young, and I don't see Sandilands playing much. You know, he's finished. He had his season finished last year with a calf injury. He starts this year with a calf injury. That, to me, tells me that Sandy's 260-odd games and his 37 years are catching up with him. And I think they were hoping when they re-signed him that he would play 8 to 11 and not get on many planes. I think he may play fewer than that. So I think it's a big year ahead for Sean Darcy, and that means Rory Lobb is probably going to be asked to do more rucking than he had planned.
I agree with you with Sandilands, but they were probably factoring in a full year from Sean Darcy. So hopefully he can shake off his injury issues pretty quickly, because that then creates a problem if he were to not be available with Sandilands at the same time. I think they need one of them out there.
The other thing I would be doing if I was Ross Lyon, and I agree with you, I think how you said he will go at that first bounce, I think it'll probably be the way he will go. But I would want Michael Walters forward and around Jesse Hogan's feet as much as possible. And I would bite the bullet and I would back in Adam Chera and Andrew Brayshaw to play more like third-year players than second-year players. I think they're both very mature young boys. I think they're both quite advanced for their years in their footy. I think they've nursed Chera a bit through the preseason. He's sort of played back mid a bit against Collingwood, and he played forward mid a bit against West Coast the other day. I would have him in around the middle, because to me, he is such a good ball user and so good with time and space. I want him with the ball in his hands as much as possible, and I want him kicking to my forwards as much as possible. So I'd back Chera in to be a midfielder.
I think those two great kids are going to be asked to do a lot this season, and I think they'll stand up to the test and show us that they're really good players already.
Okay, of course, one of the things we have been doing in the Weekend West and the Sunday Times over the last couple of weeks, and we'll be finishing off the series this weekend, we've been looking back fondly over the West Coast four premierships in 1992, 1994, 2006 and 2018. We'll have more of that in the Weekend West and the Sunday Times on Sunday. Braden, this was actually your brainchild. How have you enjoyed the exercise?
Not really mine. It was a few brains involved. It's been interesting. Just for those who may have missed the papers last weekend, we've actually we engaged Champion Data to go back through West Coast's old premiership wins and collect modern stats on those games as if they were played today. So when you buy the paper and you see match reports, you see the stats panels that come with them these days. They're actually quite complex now, and most of the statistics we run and that we talk about these days when we analyse footy didn't exist in the early 90s. So it's interesting to certainly go back and assess those games and those great players that we all remember and see just how their numbers would stack up in terms of how we analyse footy today. So I think I realised that this would be popular with fans, but what I probably didn't realise is that the players themselves from the 90s would get so much enjoyment out of it. Apparently, they've been very interested, and of course, some have had some disposals increased, some have had their tallies decreased, and so I think it's created a fair bit of humour. And one thing, I spoke to Tony Evans a couple of weeks ago, who was, of course, magnificent in both the 92 and 94 grand finals, and he said to me he'd always wondered how his numbers would have stacked up if he had played in this era. So given we've only assessed two games of his career, they're probably two games he'd be pretty proud of, I would think. So I'm not sure his career averages would match up to what we've seen in these two fantastic grand finals he played. But he's one player who certainly comes out looking very good.
So he earned himself a nickname, the Money Man, Tony, as a result of his performances in 92, 94. I actually remember being at the MCG in 1992, and Geelong were on top for a fair portion of the first half in that game, and they'd eased out to a 3 or 4 goal lead. And I think the moment I knew West Coast were going to win was after Tony Evans' second goal in the second quarter. He kicked those two goals in the second quarter. West Coast were back within two kicks at half time, and from that point on, you kind of felt that Geelong had fired their best shots at the Eagles, and the Eagles would get over the top of them in the second half. And of course, we had the heroics of Peter Matera on a wing after half time, Peter Sumich kicking 6 goals, and they won quite comfortably in the end. So
just listen to these numbers from the 92 grand final. We talk about modern footy being congested. Last year in the 2018 AFL season, across all games, an average of 39% of possessions were contested, all games in all conditions. In the 92 grand final, on a fine day, 61% of the possessions were contested. That just blew the guys at Champion Data away. Of course, footy was played in a different way back then. There were less disposals altogether. There was less chipping around to free men and a lot more trust in your teammates. And you went quickly to a one-on-one, didn't you? And you backed your man to win the draw.
Well, I think Matera, who's basically regarded as an outside runner and a finisher, I think of his 20 disposals in 1992, 11 were in contest. Am I right in saying that?
I'll be able to confirm that for you right here. 11 contested, 9 uncontested.
Yeah.
So he did both, didn't he? He won the ball in a contested situation, and pretty within a few steps, he was in an uncontested situation.
Yeah, he was pretty quick. They didn't call him the Ferrari from the bush for nothing. So last weekend we went through a couple of those great grand final wins in the Weekend West on Saturday. You are doing.
We'll be looking at the 2006 grand final, which is interesting because we think of that as modern day, but the stats have even changed a lot even since then in the last 12 years. And one of the new things that has been introduced, I think in about 2010 or 2011, which is such an everyday part of footy that we talk about now, is pressure points. Of course, forward pressure and pressure is such a big part of the modern game. And there might be something very surprising coming out of that game if you grab Saturday's paper, because of course Sydney were known as the pressure kings in that era, but perhaps the Eagles were underrated in that area.
Yeah, very good team. Oh, two very good teams, really, weren't they? The Swans and the Eagles of that 2005 to 2007 era. Of course, they had that great rivalry and that remarkable string of games that were all decided by less than a kick. You have that. I'm going to do a comparison between the Norm Smith medal winners, and I think there's a surprising result out of that as well. The four performances in 92, which is, of course, Peter Matera, 94 was Dean Kemp, 2006 was Andrew Embley, and, of course, 2018 was that remarkable game by Luke Shuey. And we got the stats gurus to run the measuring stick over those performances, and they come up with the one that they believe is the best one. And then on Sunday in the Sunday Times, we will pick our best team of premiership players, which will have a sort of a weighting of how they were over their careers and also how they performed in grand finals. And we'll also give a verdict on who we think is the best team and who I personally think was the best Norm Smith medal winner. So that's a lot to absorb for you over the weekend in the Weekend West and the Sunday Times. Of course, the other thing we're doing at the moment, Braden, is
it's a lot of footy for a weekend where we don't have any footy.
It'll keep us going until Thursday night, I think. I'm doing a top 50 at the moment, which means I'm wearing a helmet at the moment, and I'll be getting around with a helmet on for the next 2 or 3 days. You did one last year, didn't you? How did you find the exercise?
As you would have learned, there's no such thing as a correct answer. You can never keep everyone happy, and I'm not sure you can even keep most people happy, but it is an interesting exercise.
Absolutely it is. So, of course, in today's paper, we went from 30 to 21. In tomorrow's paper, we'll be going from 20 down to 11. And then in Saturday's paper, we will give you the top 10 players in the AFL as I saw them based on last year's performance and also a little bit of looking forward to this year and what they might deliver.
And just without giving your number one player away, which will be revealed in the Weekend West on Saturday, easy choice or difficult choice?
It's a good question. I think it's easy to pick the top four. I think that's what I would say. I think it's relatively easy to arrive at a top four. And if I probably asked you to pick your top four or five, I reckon you would have a minimum of four, the same as me. The order is a little bit more problematic. And I think the order could be very different at the end of this year based on how the game is going to be played. I think that, for example, in my top 10, without giving it away, there will be two ruckmen, there will be two defenders, and there will be a forward or two. I'll be interested to see what sort of role the ruckmen play with the new rules and whether they can really establish a dominance in the game again.
And just on the more open centre square situations, I'm wondering whether mids with speed are going to play a bigger part rather than your traditional slower inside mids, which have sort of owned the centre square. There's plenty of space now, and if you can use a quick player that might not traditionally have been thought of as a contested centre square player. I always remember a couple of years ago, the night the West Coast Port final went to extra time, everyone's legs were gone. You have to somehow win a clearance. Adam Simpson threw Lewis Jetta, probably the least contested player out of their 22, into the centre square, and he won clearances
when
nobody else had legs left. The one Eagle who could run on top of the ground was the player who had to go in there and win the ball and get free, and he did it. So isn't that interesting, just in terms of changing the way we traditionally think about the way clearances are won? And I just wonder, with more space now. With of course the six forwards now have to start inside the 50-meter arc, so they're not going to be able to get into the centre square to impact that contest as quickly. So it's 4-on-4. If you have a quick player that you can get free, he can either have a shot on goal or kick very deep inside 50. So it'll be interesting to see just how that mix might possibly change under the new rules.
So under the new rules, do you view, as far as the two local teams go, do you view them less or more likely to do well?
I mean, you need a bit of everything, don't you? We talk about speed, but you still need tough traditional clearance winners that can get the ball out initially, and a pretty good ruckman's not going to hurt either. Fremantle's ruck situation is a question mark. The loss of Lachie Neal puts a question mark over their clearance abilities, although they've traditionally been a good clearance team, Fremantle. The one thing they do have is blokes who can take a mark if they can get it in there quickly, which makes it even more important that they do win their share of centre clearances, and as they say, get some clean ball and quick ball inside 50. So with Fremantle, I think the question mark is on the midfield. Wouldn't West Coast love to have a fit Nick Natanui from round one? Natanui to Shuey with nobody coming at him off the square. They could do some damage there. So
I think Josh Kennedy would be running out with sort of saliva dripping from his mouth if that was the case as well.
Just one from left field. Everyone says you can't have a spare defender anymore. What stops a coach from putting a seventh defender in the wing position, starting on the point?
And just running back.
Starting on the point. He only has 20 metres to get across. He can get across in the space that ball's bounced up. So you're sacrificing a wingman perhaps, but you could play a defender type. The wingman has to stand anywhere along that 50-metre line. So he could stand at the very back edge. He only has 20 metres to move. He's at centre-half back as a spare defender. So I still think there is an option and some flexibility, and coaches will find these ways to work around these rules.
Yeah, and I think it'll happen when another team threatens to get a run. And we've already seen in the JLT Community Series a couple of times when Paddy Ryder has gone into the middle and established clear ruck dominance and spoon-fed his midfielders as Paddy can. And we've seen Port Adelaide kick 3 or 4 goals in very quick time. That'll be the time when you'll see an opposition coach position that wingman, or possibly both wingmen, at the back corner and try and get them across to give defensive help. I think you're absolutely right.
And of course, there's no rule that says it has to be an Andrew Gaff wingman. It can be a big intercept defender can start in that wing position on the back point of the square and just move across, and there he is as your seventh defender.
Or your best tackler coming across quickly to try and mow Luke Shuey down as he comes out the front end of the square. All right, so of course the other things that are going to happen this weekend in the Weekend West and in the Sunday Times. In the Weekend West, we'll have an in-depth preview of both West Coast and Fremantle. We're, as Ross would say, we're drilling in deep to the two local teams and sort of looking at their chances, their draws, their personnel and how they're going to go this year. And then, of course, in the Sunday Times, we have the full AFL preview lift out, all 18 teams covered, their strengths and weaknesses, our premiership ladders, what our predictions are going to be. Braden, are you ready to give yours? Who is your likely flag winner in 2019?
No, I'm not ready to give
it. You haven't decided yet?
I haven't even submitted mine for our season preview that we'll write in the paper on Sunday. So it will be up to date. there's about 5 teams I like, and I know no one particularly outside of this state are liking West Coast. I think they're as well placed as any team has been to go back to back with stars coming back, the motivation that provides, and some good young players creating selection pressure from underneath. I think they're in a good spot. But of course, the year will bring challenges.
Absolutely. You become a target, don't you, when you're the reigning premier. I like West Coast. I think they're 1 of 5 that I like, just ahead of the pack. I really liked what I saw of Collingwood, and I like what Dane Beams will bring to them, and I like what, if they can keep Jamie Elliott out there, I think I really like what he can bring to them as well. So
I find it hard to go past, for West Coast and Collingwood to make the grand final last year with the amount of adversity they faced and the amount of players they lost. That was a magnificent achievement from Collingwood as well to do what they did. And it reveals a bit about what those clubs and those players are made of as well. The law of averages says that perhaps they get a better run with injury this year. So they're going to take some stopping.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you for joining us this morning. We're going to be back on Tuesday, of course. The other quarters and I in the run into round one and that big game, the Carlton Richmond game, on Thursday night, which has become the traditional season opener. Should it still be the season opener, Braden?
I don't think so.
Yeah, it's become a bit. What are you expecting from Carlton this year?
They couldn't be any worse, but I've been expecting them to improve for a couple of years now. That will have to improve. They've got some good young players. I can't see how they could not improve.
Sooner or later,
the
top-end young players get better, don't they, sooner or later?
I'm not sure why we can't begin each season with the grand final rematch. We can organise a final in the space of a week, but we can't organise the grand final rematch to be the round one season opener in 6 months.
I get the feeling that because Carlton have been struggling and because they got gutted by salary cap penalties and have basically not really been a force in the competition since, that they're trying to give them a big earner in round one that sort of like sets them alight and gives their fans some reason to believe. I think it's purely an equalisation mechanism.
I just think it's become Groundhog Day, doesn't it? How many years have we had this game with Richmond, a short price favourite, having a big win over Carlton in round one? And I think everyone looks forward to the Friday night game, the second game, more because it's a bit more of a more competitive fixture on paper. So I'm looking forward to next Friday night more than next Thursday night.
All right. Just quickly before we go, the new rules, the set positions, you a tick?
I'll hold my judgment on that. In general, I'm for less changes, less new rules. I'm not sure what was wrong with footy 20, 25 years ago. Speaking about the early 90s, that was a decent brand. It was decent to watch, wasn't it? I think already with some of the things we've seen in the pre-season, if good midfielders are allowed more time and space to shine and good forwards get a chance to take ball marks and kick more goals, I don't think there's going to be too many complaints. So the AFL might come out of this, out of all these changes, looking better than we'd all imagined.
No runners, happy?
I don't have a big problem with the runner crackdown. It seems to be some of the poorer clubs and maybe clubs with younger players seem to be angriest about this. I think it's a chance for your senior players to maybe take a bit more control. And again, with just speaking about how things can be manipulated, I think we've already seen in the pre-season, your wingman can run over to the bench and get a little messages. Message and then spread them as well. So we'll see all these sorts of things.
Okay. What about the 50-metre penalties? We saw that get a bit farcical in the North Melbourne-Port Adelaide game at the weekend.
If you look how many free kicks were paid in the last quarter of the grand final between West Coast and Collingwood, I'm not sure any of those umpires would have the guts to be paying a 100-metre penalty in a close grand final. And that's the test with these things. It's all very well paying 100-metre penalties in pre-season games. Are these going to be paid in close grand finals? I think we see changes in interpretation, don't we?
But you're saying the old human nature still kicks in late in a close game.
And we see when there's controversy, particularly in the Melbourne media, that it can have an influence. And I suspect that if there's enough anger about these double 50-metre penalties, that they might just drift out of the game. And I would have serious doubt to whether we'd see one in a grand final. I don't think it would be paid.
You're saying the Melbourne media wields a big influence over the AFL, Braden? Oh, come on. Heaven forbid. All right, one last one before we close off today. A twilight grand final, you for or against?
I don't have a problem with it. I understand that people are against it and there's a lot of anger, but I'm not sure we're committing to it for the next 50 years like we have done with the venue of the grand final. I've got a bigger problem with that. Can't we just try? I don't have a problem with trying a twilight grand final for once. Just try it for. I don't think it will happen this year. I reckon it's next year at the earliest in 2020. I don't have a problem with a one-off. Can't we try it once and go back to a day game the next year? I don't think we just have to give away our day games forever.
I suspect the traditionalists know that if we try it once, there'll be no going back because it'll be a better product, particularly on television, and it'll make them extra money. And also, I think they can do things with their halftime entertainment that they haven't been able to do before. Overall, the overall product on Grand Final Day will be a better product, I think.
The strange thing we see about any of these types of changes is that if we tried a twilight Grand Final and it was a terrible one-sided game, we probably wouldn't see it the next year. But if we tried it and it was an absolutely cracking game, people would come around to the concept more, even though that has nothing to do with the time the game started. So there's a lot of moving parts to these things. If we had a great game, I don't think there would be a huge amount of opposition to doing it again.
Braden Quatermain, thank you for joining us today. Thank you for sharing your thoughts on football with us. As I mentioned before, we'll be back on Tuesday with Glenn Quatermain in the big run into round one. We've been brought to you today by Tab Touch. Thank you, listeners, for joining us. And let's get ready and let's get excited for footy next week.
This has been the Duff and Quarters podcast, brought to you by Tab Touch.